Go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Scott Benjamin.
And I'm Bolin. Ben Bolin.
Oh, very nice. I was going to say, just Bolin. What are you going about, like Madonna or something? What's the one name? Very slick.
Yeah, kind of like Samson.
Sure. Oh, okay, better.
Yeah, I'll take it back. I mean, I would trade Samson for Madonna. But we're not talking about either of those people, Scott. We, if you can't tell from my awkward attempt to make a secret agent joke that did fall a little flat.
Is that what that was?
Oh, you're like, what was that? Was that a joke?
Sorry,
oh,
piling on.
I thought jokes were funny. but we're doing another podcast from this excellent Christmas gift.
Yeah, it's Automotive Mysteries, Myths and Rumors Revealed. And it's got so many fascinating stories in it that we just can't seem to stay away from it recently. I mean, it's got great, great stories. I mean, they grip you.
Yeah, from Ferrari burials to possible concept cars of the future lost at sea.
Yeah, the Norseman.
This has everything.
Well, this has a similar angle to it as the Norseman story, right?
Yes. So we're all familiar with James Bond, right?
I think so.
Is that a fair assumption to make for our listeners?
Yeah.
Okay. And if you are familiar with James Bond films at all, then of course you are familiar with the iconic Aston Martin sports cars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like every single James Bond movie is, I don't know, that's one of the stars of the movie, really, is the Aston Martin cars that he drives, or even any cars that he drives, really. But the Aston Martins have always been there from the very beginning, and this goes way back to the beginning, right?
Yes, this goes way back. We're talking about the Aston Martin DB5 sports cars that were used in the filming and promotion of the films Goldfinger and Thunderball. Did you see those, Scott?
no, I didn't. No, I didn't. I'm not a huge Bond fan. Uh-huh. I've watched a couple of them recently, and it pains me to reveal this, but I haven't watched every single James Bond movie. I've watched parts of them because they have fantastic stunts, and amazing
great
cars,
action sequences,
and lots of really cool gadgets and all that. I've watched the recent ones. I haven't gone back through the whole history of James Bond and watched from the beginning.
You know what?
How about you?
I don't blame you. I've seen every James Bond film.
Really?
Yeah, well, I grew up with a station that's called TBS, and so TBS and USA and those kind of stations went through a big James Bond phase. So I saw most of them. I saw them growing up. One of my favorite things, of course, for a guy like me, is the gadgets. The gadgets, especially the ones in the vehicle.
Yeah.
And I always wondered, as a wee tyke, whether or not they actually worked. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to touch on that a little bit here, because when we're talking about the Aston Martin DB5.
And because it comes from this book, you might assume that, you know, there's something up with this car, right?
Twist.
Now, the twist is that the legend, as it goes, is that these cars were stolen. One of the cars was stolen.
Ooh, one of four.
One of four. We'll talk about that, too. But one of four was stolen as part of an insurance fraud scheme, right?
Yeah.
And the assumption is that it was dumped out of an airplane somewhere off the Florida coast, and it's out in the ocean even right now as we speak.
Just there, south of the Norseman.
Yeah, exactly. And we'll find out, you know, if maybe that's true, or if they even find out anything, really, if there's any leads in this thing, because it's quite a twisted story.
Yeah, and I've got to, just so we know, I think I've said this four times off air before we started filming, but I do have a surprise
for
you here at the end. So it's got to be the very last thing, though.
Looking forward to it. So one more thing, right?
Yeah, it's a one more thing. And for a lot of people, the first question is going to be, hey, guys, why four cars?
Yeah, it's a good question, right?
It's a really good question.
Because a lot of people would assume that there's just one car that does, you know, the duty for the whole movie, or maybe there's, you know, several because, you know, they want to have them just in case there's a crash or whatever.
Right.
That's not necessarily the case, but in a way, yes, I guess, maybe.
Yeah, it's partially true.
Partially true, but the reality of this whole thing is that there were really two cars for the movies.
Yes, and there were two cars that were actually in the film.
In the film, a total of four cars, and we'll describe this, I promise. But there's one car that they would call the beauty car or the star car.
Yes.
And the star car is the one that, you know, the talent, who was at the time Sean Connery, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sean Connery as James Bond. He would appear in this car for like all the close-ups and all the driving scenes where he's actually behind the wheel, not the stunt driver. This is where he's actually driving, you know, talking to somebody, whatever.
Deploying gadgets.
Exactly. So this is a very clean, very well put together car that has all the bells and whistles and everything operates the way it should be.
And it is modified.
And it is definitely modified. Yeah, this one has got all of the stuff in it. It's got, you know, it truly has like the oil slick dispenser. It truly has the machine guns. It has the
license plates.
Yeah, the license plates, the phone that's mounted in the door.
Yeah.
All kinds of really cool stuff. But the problem is now, you know, this car for the close ups, it's got all this stuff. It's very heavy.
Right, because let's keep in mind that a lot of this stuff actually works, like that revolving license plate.
Isn't
thing.
That cool?
Yeah.
The James Bond car originally had all these gadgets that really did what they said they did or that they appeared to do in the movie.
And so when this is all added to the vehicle, it makes it so heavy that it changes the handling and lowers the acceleration rate.
Yeah, and for a secret agent like James Bond, he doesn't want to be right around town in a dog of a car, right? So they've got a very lightweight version of this, an unmodified car, really. It's just a standard DB5.
And it's called the stunt car.
Exactly. And the stunt car is just meant for the driving scenes that, you know, the high performance scenes.
Right.
Anything that if Sean is driving, it's passing by at high speed and you don't see all the extra stuff that would be in the star car.
Mm-hmm.
So the stunt car is much lighter weight, not quite as heavy, and later in life, this thing would be fitted with all the Bond gadgets, but
right.
After the movie. So, you know, it wasn't until, like, these movies are done, because there's a pair of movies that we mentioned, 1964 mm-hmm. Goldfinger,
and then
a follow-up in 65, which was
Thunderball,
that's right. And so later it would get all the gadgets, but initially the stunt car was pretty stripped down, pretty bare.
So those are the two cars that were actually in the film, what we'll call the star car and the stunt car.
And then later, there were two more cars that were built. This is for the 1965 movie Thunderball.
Mm-hmm.
And those were used strictly for the publicity tour.
Yeah.
So anytime they were sent out to film premieres, you know, mm-hmm. like around wherever they happened to be, around the world, really, television appearances, photo shoots, anything like that.
Right.
A couple of these additional vehicles that were just strictly for promotional purposes were used. So we're talking about a total of four Aston Martin DB4s at this, or DB5s rather, at
yeah.
this point. Funny slip there, because the DB4, the original, this kind of comes into play later,
mm-hmm.
The star car, the very first one that they made was actually the prototype DB5 that was made from a DB4 from the previous model version. So this car in Aston Martin history becomes a very valuable piece of it's a very valuable piece of automotive history. It was actually
yeah.
the prototype DB5 that was used in the movies.
And it's an important car even outside of the James Bond history there too.
Yeah, a lot of
because
people,
of the Aston Martin connection.
A lot of people just love this car because it has connection to the movie.
Mm-hmm.
It has it's a part of automotive history with Aston Martin being this prototype vehicle, and people just fall all over themselves to get to see these cars, to get to be around these cars.
Yeah.
Even the ones, Ben, that weren't in the movie, which is kind of strange.
Right.
The ones that are just the publicity cars because they have this association with James Bond. And to be honest, Ben, these are just really cool cars.
I mean, they're beautiful vehicles. They are, you know, this is going to come back to bite me up later on in the podcast. But Scott, we're going to run into a guy who agrees that these vehicles are works of art.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, definitely.
But so we'll get up to that point. For right now, what we want to underline here is that people love these cars. After their film careers are over, these vehicles end up in private hands.
Yeah, and they've all got, and I think we should definitely state this, that they've all got a chassis number, and that's how they were
yeah.
identified from the factory and through this historian that went through and decided that, you know, or not decided, but determined mm-hmm. that that you know this was the star car, this was the stunt car, these were the two promotional vehicles,
right.
And they've all got their own chassis number, and so they're very clearly identified. At some later point, this all happened, right? Someone took a good long time to do this.
David Worrell, I believe.
Okay,
Bond enthusiast and author. He has a book about the Bond Aston Martins called The Most Famous Car in the World, The Complete History of the James Bond Aston Martin DB5. Now, I haven't read this book, Scott.
I haven't either, but it's a bold statement.
It is a bold statement. I would love to check it out.
The most famous car in the world?
Really?
I don't know. We'll see.
We'll see.
There's at least one person who will argue with him. I'll tell you that, because I'll tell you about her in a moment.
Yeah.
But, okay, let's get back to this.
Chassis numbers.
Now, the chassis numbers, and, you know, we know which car is which, and I've got, you know, there's an article that states, you know, each one and, you know, what duty it served on the film.
And the line of ownership afterwards.
Exactly. Yeah, there's a long line of ownership, as a matter of fact. These things trade hands often. They go to auction quite a bit. So there's, you know, it's no secret that they're passed around quite a bit. It's not like the original owner, the studio owns them or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
They're passed around from, you know, private collector to private collector, and a lot of times they remain anonymous, and, you know, some people display them in museums. So you may see them on publicity tours, things like that. And that's kind of where this guy comes in. Now, in 1986, so, you know, there's been a long line of owners of all of these cars at this point. But in 1986, the star car, the main vehicle that was used in Goldfinger.
Yeah, that's the one with the gadgets.
With all the gadgets. Was sold at auction to Anthony Pugliese? Is that right?
Yeah, let's go with Anthony Pugliese. Anthony B. Pugliese III.
Yeah.
I'm not 100% on that pronunciation,
okay.
But
he's a let's just call him Anthony.
Okay.
Anthony was a resident of Florida, and he bought the car for about $250,000, and this is in 1986 again.
Mm-hmm.
So $250,000. And a lot of money to spend on a car, but, you know, this thing has a lot of history to it. It's an Aston Martin, for one. I mean, that's really cool. He and his brother, his brother-in-law, I should say, his name was Robert Luongo.
Mm-hmm. And they decided, you know, they treat this as an investment, which I can really respect.
Sure.
They take the star car on a tour and...
Yeah, like a whirlwind, worldwide, really.
Publicity tour.
Yeah, like a promotional publicity tour, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're trying... What are they trying to do with this? They're trying to build up the value of the car, right?
Right, and thinking that they would be able to sell this at a profit.
Yes.
Over $250,000.
Yeah. So they buy it for $250,000. They figure they'll promote the heck out of this thing for as long as it takes, and just build and build and build the level of excitement around this car. And they did that. I mean,
they did it successfully.
I mean, the guy Robert Longo, I guess he's the one who really toured with the car, and he would set it up. He would set up the entire display. He was in charge of handling the vehicle. They call it wrangling. He would wrangle the vehicle in and out of, you know, whatever display that it was being set up in or wherever it was, the show.
Oh, I'm sorry. We got to point out this was a long tour. Because they got the car in 1986.
Yeah.
We don't know exactly when they began the tour, but it wasn't over until, you know, the 90s.
Yeah, the late 90s. We're talking 1997. So this is like an 11-year tour. Now, this guy is traveling with this car at all these exhibits like the Peterson Museum.
Sure.
He goes to all the, you know, the big time shows and museums to display this car.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, people love it because it's a James Bond car, right?
And the gadgets work. I'm never going to let go of that. The gadgets work.
Can I tell you something about the gadgets though?
Yeah.
I don't mean to burst your bubble.
I know. They don't all work.
No. That's not what I'm getting at here. I've got something from another article here that I want to get to in a moment. But, one thing that I want to say about the gadgets is that, let's see. Oh, the star car, the original star car, the one that they have.
Yeah.
Now, after the publicity tours, Aston Martin took control of the vehicle again at some point. You know, I'm talking the publicity tours from the movie itself.
Oh, yes.
So way back in the late 60s, early 70s, Aston Martin retrieved the vehicle. They stripped off all of the weaponry at that point. They removed everything that that made it the gadget, you know, encased vehicle that it was. You know, it had gadgets everywhere, right?
Right.
They took all that off and they sold it. And then it was they completely restored the car. And then later it was retrofitted with non-original weapons in the 1970s. So the car that Anthony Pugliese and
Richard Luongo.
Richard Luongo were touring with was a retrofitted vehicle. It had retrofitted gadgets. Now, the gadgets may have operated, but they're not the authentic 1967 or 1965, whatever the year was, I forget.
Yeah, my bubble remains unburst. I'm fine.
That's okay. I totally agree with you in that, you know, they're still there. Yeah. All the gadgets that were there are still there, but they're just not the original.
At this point in time.
At this point in time. So I didn't mean to shoot that down or whatever, but I figured we better get that little point out there.
Yeah, and it's funny because this is just an interesting thing for everyone to tell their friends when you guys are talking about this story, right, after this podcast. Do you know how long the Aston Martin DB5 is actually on screen in the James Bond films?
No, I have no idea.
It's nuts.
How long?
Just take a guess.
I'm going to guess 30 minutes total.
You know what? Not a bad guess. 13 minutes.
Less than half of what I guessed.
Yeah, that's 13, so that's how long it takes to be the most famous car in the world.
And it created that much of an impression on people.
Heck yes, it did. It's got machine guns.
Yeah, of course it did. Yeah, that's an amazing car.
So I just wanted to point that out, but now we're really getting to the meat of this because the attempt to raise the car's perceived value via a promotional tour appears to work.
Yeah, totally worked.
Yeah, because the car, surprise, surprise, which was purchased for $250,000, is later appraised by Grundy Worldwide Incorporated for $4.2 million.
That's amazing. And you know what? Here's the other crazy part about this. Now Jim Grundy, who is the insurance agent, who actually set up this policy with a company called Chubb Insurance. Mm-hmm. And, that's actually 80% of the appraised value of the car. So they appraised the car at 20% higher than that even. So $4.2 million represents 80% of the appraised value of the car when they set up this policy. So they had really, done quite a job in promoting this thing, right?
Yes.
Amazing. And we're up to what, 1997 at this point, right?
Yeah, we are.
Now something bad happens in 1997, and this is where the controversy comes in.
Right. This is where we start to run directly into the legend. Now, what's interesting about the way this is written in the book is that they say that the Aston Martin is stored at a warehouse, but that's not completely accurate, is it?
No, not exactly. And this is what caused a lot of confusion for me. Just this morning, I had to come in and dig up some more information, which really cleared things up, and I'll share it with everybody. Mm-hmm. But the book says that it was stored in a Boca Raton, Florida warehouse.
It wasn't Boca Raton.
It truly was Boca Raton, that's right. But it wasn't a warehouse, Ben. What was it?
It was an aircraft hangar.
And that makes a huge difference.
Right.
And the reason is because here's the story as it is in the book, and the way that, you know, everybody generally knows this is that the car that was stored in this this hangar was stolen in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm.
Very forcefully. I mean, it wasn't very gentle at all in the way
right.
that this thing was stolen.
This was a forced entry. The padlocks are cut. The security alarm is deactivated.
Yeah, there was a gate that was yanked off with a chain and a truck. Uh-huh. They hooked a chain up to the axle of it and just drug it across the ground until they could bring it out into an open area. Uh-huh. And this is where this jump in logic happens. They say at that point it was loaded onto a plane.
Yeah, and this is interesting because the kind of plane that it would have been most likely loaded on, the kind of plane that could get in and out of there without some remarkable spectacle, right, mm-hmm. is probably going to have some difficulties carrying a car of that weight.
Yeah, it would have been just kind of like a mid-sized plane, right?
Right.
A cargo plane. Mm-hmm. But the thing that really got me about this is mm-hmm. that when they made this jump from, it was towed out of this warehouse and put onto a plane at that point. And I was thinking, how did that happen? So
yeah.
I went into this other story because they do mention another story from another author.
Yes.
And there's another article that is called, and it's from a,
from Motor Trend, right?
Yes, yeah, from a Motor Trend article that was published back in 2006, in May of 2006. And it's called, 1965 Aston Martin DB5. Now pay attention, 007, one of your Aston Martins is missing. So this article by, what's her name? Mary Seelhorst. She's the one who first of all cleared up that it was a hangar, not a warehouse for me. Because in the book it says warehouse. So the hangar thing, that makes more sense that, you know, they're already at the airport. But the idea is that it was put onto a plane, sometime in the middle of the night, just flown out somewhere over the coast of Florida, off the coast of Florida, about 75 miles, and the car was just dumped overboard somewhere into the ocean. It's part of some, you know, natural reef now at this point, right?
Right. The
man-made reef.
And we have an episode on man-made reefs as well, for anybody interested.
Yes, we do.
It's one of our deep cuts. You're going to have to scroll through the iTunes.
Now, I know this is getting a little confusing. Can I just...
Yeah.
So the idea is that this thing is... So it's bought for $250,000.
And the value's raised to, what, around, I guess, around $6 million at that point?
Well, something like that, about that total. But it's insured for $4.2 million.
Yep.
Stored in an airport hangar. One night when no one sees what's going on, none of the staff or anything.
And there's supposed to be 24-hour security here.
Exactly. There's this really, like, I mean, this would have caused a lot of commotion. I mean, the type of theft that this happened, because they could, you know, see that it was drug, you know, across the floor.
There are tire tracks.
Yeah, tire tracks. And so this thing was stolen, loaded onto a plane, flown somewhere, and it's never been seen again. It has completely disappeared. And I would think that, you know, if it was somewhere on land, this thing would have turned up by now.
And here's where our stories begin to divide, because there are some people who say that they believe the vehicle was dumped in the ocean.
Sure, yeah.
And that it's part of the reef, as you said. Originally, when Anthony P., our owner at the time of the theft, was talking about it, he said several things. I've got some quotations here. He said, it's really kind of wild that someone had the nerve to steal it. And he's talking to the Boca Raton News.
Mm-hmm.
What are they going to do with it? I think that's an excellent question. I often wonder about that when it comes to you know, priceless works of art that are stolen. It's like, where are you gonna fence that, buddy?
All right, Well, this is actually coming from this article, but it's a good point, and it's one that I had also thought of as well.
What's that?
That you know, aside from, you know, insurance fraud, which would have paid off handsomely on this thing, and it did. We'll find out.
Yeah.
There's also this kind of group of people that, you know, like a car collectors, these maybe obsessed car collectors. This thing could be just sitting in someone's house. It could be in a living room somewhere or in a basement, and some collector just every day goes down and sits behind the wheel of that thing and says,
slightly polishes,
"How cool, I've got the James Bond car."
And I'm, you know,
I'm going to go to bed now.
That's funny, because one of the other Aston Martin DB5s, one of the other four, was owned by a guy, a Mr. Lee, I believe, who did actually keep it in this themed room.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Through charity events and stuff. Well, and also, Anthony Pugliese probably agrees with you. His theory was, why would anyone go to all that trouble, you know, and to steal it and dump it in the ocean? I'm quoting here. This might be an offensive quote to some people. Pugliese says, "I believe it is still sitting in some Arab sheikh's tent." Which is not the most correct way, politically correct way to say that kind of stuff. But obviously, he's a little irritated, right?
He's alluding to the fact that it may still be on dry land somewhere.
And just stolen.
And that it's just stolen. Some collector who really appreciates this thing is just looking at it every day saying, "I've got this," and no one in the world knows where it is.
And if they had those sorts of resources to steal a vehicle, like, they'd have to pay off the security guards, first off. That's one thing.
Sure.
Then they'd have to charter a flight with an aircraft that was capable of carrying this thing.
Without being able to be traced, because, you know, one thing that we need to mention here is that, you know, the Boca Raton police, and as well as Chubb Insurance with their own investigators, they went out and they immediately canvassed all of the local airports to find out who had, you know, chartered a flight, any planes that were capable of doing this type of thing in the area, and they, you know, investigated those. I'm sure that they had a good, you know, hard look inside those and made sure that there was nothing in them, around them, or evidence of this type of thing happening.
They offered $30,000 as a reward for information.
Quite a bit of money, that's right. So, you know, that's a decent reward. Also, you know, just everybody, everybody would have to keep their lips shut about this thing. I mean, you know, you couldn't.
Yeah.
And that's the hard part. When you get more and more people involved, someone's going to talk.
Yeah, it's like that old quotation, three people can keep a secret as long as two of them are dead.
That's a good point. Yeah. I haven't heard that.
So Mr. Grundy, there's some tension here because Mr. Grundy says, I think that car is a pile of deteriorated aluminum in the Gulf Stream off the coast of Florida. He said, I can't prove it, but I'd bet on it.
Yep, and here's the guy that has to pay out $4.2 million, right? Because because he has insured this thing for that much. Now, later, Ben, later. Now, I guess we should just say that, you know, the insurance policy, after all these lawsuits and everything happened, you know, there's a lot of tension there, a lot of, you know, what happened. They eventually did pay. They paid the $4.2
million. And this, the case to this day remains unsolved.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of tension now between the guy that was, you know, touring with this car. What was his name? Not Anthony, but
Longo?
Robert Longo. Now, Robert says that, you know, he should be entitled to a certain amount of money, like a like it was like 10% of the value of the car, plus his time for, you know, all the time that he had gone out promoting this thing.
Oh yeah.
And so, you know, a significant portion of this this $4.2 million, and I think he eventually was awarded some money, actually quite a bit of money. And as a matter of fact, Ben, this is where this all comes together, and I encourage people to read this article because it ties all this up really nicely. The Mary Sealhorst article from 2006, Motor Trend. You can find it online. It's pretty easy. She says that later, you know, because she was somehow involved in this, Ben. She was she was related to this story in a way that she worked at the Henry Ford in Detroit when they came for part of the publicity tour. So prior to 1997, and I think it was 3 years prior to that. Or no, I'm sorry, maybe it was in 1997. But in 2000, I think it was the year 2000, she was called to testify for the prosecution. And the prosecution, really, what they wanted was, and she comes clean about all of this right at the end of her article. So in April of 2000, she's in the courthouse because she had met with these characters and, you know, was interested in the story and, you know, knew one of them. Knew Longo, did not know Anthony Pugliese. The prosecution wanted was her opinion. She said, and I'm reading from the story here, the attorney asked me if I thought the Goldfinger Aston Martin DB5 was really the most famous car in the world. And she says, no, I think the most famous car is the Lincoln limo President Kennedy was shot in or was assassinated in. And he says, well, you know, the attorney asked why. She says, because it's a great unsolved mystery surrounding the event. And the car remains constantly in the public eye. It's on exhibit. You know, it's there at the Henry Ford.
Right.
It's in the Zapruder film, which a lot of people, you know, see all the time. It's in dozens of documentaries, books, and movies all the time. So it's her, you know, they were just asking her if she thought that this was the most valuable car in the world and what her opinions were about it because she had come into contact with one of these characters. And then just so happens that she's writing a story about the same vehicle. Well, she had written the story, I should say.
Yeah.
4 years prior, and that's why they called her, because she had this connection with him.
I've got something for you that's going to be an even weirder connection.
Well, what's that?
And it's a tangential connection.
What's that?
In one of the – in AP's report, 1997, June 21st report about the theft of the vehicle from Boca, there's this interesting quotation. I'm just going to read it to you, Scott.
All right.
The car belongs to collector Anthony Pugliese, who also owns the gun Jack Ruby used to shoot Lee Harvey Oswald.
What? What a tie-in, huh?
What a weird tie-in.
Yeah.
That's like, that reminds me of that thing, you know, when people play the coincidence game and they add up all the coincidences between Lincoln and Kennedy or the night before. And, you know, of course you can find coincidences whenever you decide you want to see them. There's that whole Bader-Meinhof syndrome.
That's amazing. You found, how did you dig that up?
Well, these are just some of the original, like, news reports from when the theft occurred.
Interesting.
And I've got that surprise.
Well, I'll tell you what. Why don't you wait? Because I just want to say that, you know, there was all this tension between them. And the thing is, like, I think he got Luongo was actually awarded. I think it was just over $1 million. They said he got 10% of the insurance money plus half the 1966 $1.2 million uptick in the appraised value of the car.
Oh.
So he actually got quite a bit of money. The jury only deliberated like 42 minutes or something. They decided that, you know, he was the one who, you know, had done all the legwork on this thing. He deserved a cut of the pay. A lot of the people that, you know, where they displayed the car, they didn't even know the owner of the vehicle. They only knew the guy that was, you know, on tour with it, the brother-in-law. Now, at that point, now here's the thing. Like, they're in court and, you know, they're battling this thing out.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a couple of, the funny thing is a lot of people would assume that there's only one motive here, right? The motive would be insurance fraud. You know, the money, right?
Yeah, that's still an assumption, though. It's not proven.
No, it's not proven. And the crazy thing is that it wasn't the only possibility. They say that, you know, by then the two were no longer brothers-in-law. So apparently there was a divorce in there somewhere. And they've been at odds about how to deal with the car the entire time since then. You know, because at first they had to kind of deal with each other because they're a family.
Mm-hmm.
They work things out, you know, according to the way, you know, the families do that kind of thing often. But at this point, they didn't care. They were just, they were at odds all the time. And, so it could have been, you know, there's a little bit of jealousy involved or some revenge involved.
Sure, yeah.
A little bit of spite. And, they also, you know, the other thing is, you know, even in the court, I think they threw this in, is that there could be this unnamed collector out there somewhere that has it. And I kind of like to believe that maybe that's where it is.
Yeah, me too, Scott.
I like to think that, you know, I'll be 60 years old someday and someone's going to, you know, somehow this thing's going to resurface. Mm-hmm. There's going to be a lot of questions, you know, that are asked to that person at that point. But I would love to see this thing resurface.
It's going to resurface maybe in the North Korean museum where they show gifts from around the world.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there are car. I think there's a train in one of those museums.
Really?
A train car.
Oh, that's interesting.
But,
okay,
I love that. A real-life Bond villain, like a Bond-level supervillain, may have stolen the car.
That's really cool. And there's this whole mystery involved around it. So, you know, the legend from the book, you know, that it was stolen and dumped off the coast of Florida, it's unproven at this point. I mean, you can't say either way until they find the car or, you know, somebody speaks or, you know, pipes up that, you know, I know the details about this. And I think it'll always be kind of like a D.B. Cooper thing. Like a lot of people claim that this is what happened and they investigate it for a mm-hmm. while and then that just kind of trails off into nothing. And then, you know, there's another case, you know, 5 years later and the same thing. So I think this story has a lot of the same element to it.
Now, we should point out that the reason we talked about whether or not Aston Martin is a work of art there is because the appraisers, when they appraised it at such a high price, part of the reason was that they saw it as a work of art.
Yeah.
So that's why I brought that line in there.
As possibly the most valuable car in the world, remember? Or the most, what was it?
The most famous.
The most famous car in the world. And that's exactly why they brought in the author of that Motor Trend article to say, hey, do you think that this is the most famous car in the world? You work in museums. You write for an automotive journal, you know, a publication. What do you think? And she said, no, I don't think that's the
and
most
she,
famous.
She instead proposed a conspiracy theory about the assassination of JFK, which, you know, in a lot of circles won't do much for the credibility.
No, probably not. But you know what? There's a lot surrounding that car that makes it. I think she's onto something. I think that maybe
yeah.
I was trying to rack my brain over what I thought was the most famous car in the world. And I think that maybe she's exactly right with that. Now, please. Let's hear the secret. I'm dying to know. So this is one more thing, right?
This is one more thing. We should get some theme music for this, too. Okay, so one more thing, Scott. I did a little digging into Mr. Anthony V. Pugliese III.
Okay.
I still am not 100% on pronunciation of his name.
Well, you've already shocked me with the gun ownership thing. that was pretty amazing.
From our earlier podcast?
No, today, just now.
Ah, yes. Well, it's true. 2006, October 16th, Mr. Pugliese is in the news again. Delray Beach developer Anthony Pugliese charged with money laundering and fraud as part of a scheme to con Subway founder out of $1.2 million.
Wait, Subway... Restaurants?
Yeah, Fred DeLuca, founder of Subway Restaurants.
He's trying to pull some kind of con on the owner of the Subway sandwich franchise.
That's the charge.
Oh my gosh.
Oh wait, excuse me. That picture was from 2006. This is a more recent story. The idea here is this, that for years, big-time Delray Beach developer Anthony Pugliese padded his pockets with Subway mogul Fred DeLuca's money, say investigators, creating fake companies and phony invoices to bilk this founder out of nearly $1.2 million that was supposed to be going toward a 41,000-acre green community south of Orlando.
Well, well, well. Well, you know, okay.
Now, of course, this is not saying that he stole the car.
Oh, come on, Ben. This is a case. I mean, this is one of those cases where, like, you look at the current behavior, you look back at the past behavior and what he was accused of and charged. This is right along the same lines, right? I mean, insurance fraud versus what is this, money laundering, or what was this whole thing?
Right. So the idea is that the idea here and the charges are that, yeah, he was laundering money and pretty much swindling Fred DeLuca.
So it's like an extortion case, really.
The charges against Pugliese, who, check this out, over the years has become a political force in Palm Beach County and sits on the committee that nominates local judges, stem from a $5 billion lawsuit he filed in 2009 against DeLuca.
$5 billion with a B.
Hey, man, when you like money, you like money.
Oh, my gosh. Ben, I can't tell you this. If I had known this ahead of time, it's almost like you'd want to point the finger at him even more, you know,
didn't think it was fair to point it out at the beginning.
Probably not.
So there was an arrest. Investigators are saying that out of the 111 million, Scott, that DeLuca invested, $6 million was set aside for expenses related to the properties, and the investigators say Pugliese blew through it in 2 years. Let me just give you an example. According to the arrest report, Pugliese and an employee at one point discussed the creation of a fake invoice to subsidize an $11,000, get this, moat chiller for waters surrounding Pugliese's expansive home. The two warm waters were causing the fish inside the moat to die.
Oh, my gosh.
So that's how much a moat chiller costs, if you've ever wondered.
A moat chiller? I've never even heard of that. It's an interesting thought.
It's a different world.
Yeah.
So also $79,524 for a high-end audio-video system.
Wait. He's got a moat around his house. That says something,
he has a moat.
That's interesting. That's cool. Okay, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Go
ahead. No, you're fine. $23,587 for bush hog payments, lawn care services for Pugliese, $6,100 for a Zen house. It's a structure where you meditate. In total, he says he received $21,571. And these charges are... I didn't see how this conviction worked out, and I do want to say that without knowing how the conviction worked out, perhaps it's already been through court.
So these are alleged. These are alleged
charges. Just for the purposes of our podcast, I don't feel that it's fair to say that he stole, like that he did fraud with Aston Martin, or that he built the Subway founder. But I will say that he's in the news two times for these things.
Similar things, decades apart.
The choice is yours, listeners, and we don't feel that it is we don't feel that it's slanderous to report what is being said in the news on public record about this guy. We feel that it would be unfair to, I feel that it would be unfair for me to definitively say that he did either of these things. A moat chiller, though.
A moat chiller.
That's
interesting.
Off.
Yeah.
So what do you think? Does it change your mind a little?
It does change my mind. You know what? I'll tell you this. It changes my mind completely. I always thought the story sounds really dirty to begin with. You know, the theft of this car and the way it was removed in the middle of the night it should have been spotted by somebody at the airport. There should have been something going on. I'm sure there's a payoff going on there.
Right.
It just seems like there's a lot that was unaccounted for during that one night when this thing was going down.
Yeah, a lot of, if there are coincidences, it's quite a few coincidences.
Yeah, it sure seems like that. And then, you know, for them to insure the car for $4.2 million or have it insured for this excessive amount of money. And, you know, the insurance agent later said, I should have only insured it for $500,000 or $1 million. It was my mistake. But, you know, they came to him asking for this.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, then to have this thing disappear, it just seems like it's just all a little bit too clean, a little too set up, you know, for me. And then later, you know, a decade later to hear about, you know, something like this going on.
Yeah.
To me, this just, it just points a finger at somebody that, you know, is involved in some stuff that maybe they shouldn't be.
So you're saying he calls into question the character?
He's a little too close to a lot of bad things that are happening, I think.
All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and get out of here today. Guys, we hope you enjoyed one of our podcasts on some more mysterious car stories. Please do write in and tell us. What do you think people should write in and tell us today?
Oh, my gosh, anything. If there's car mysteries all around. I mean, we've got, a few examples that we've done in the years past, right?
Right.
If you look at our RSS feed, you can find a lot of those. And, we like mysteries around, Halloween, so look around those dates. but if you can think of any car mysteries that you'd like to hear explained or maybe at least just even brought up, and, if there's no answer, that's fine. We just like to talk about them.
Yeah, we have a lot of fun with these, you guys. So please let us know what you think. You can find us on Facebook. Drop us a line on Twitter. We definitely read both of those. Or, you know what? Cut past the social media middleman and send us an email directly at
carstuff@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.